So our next speaker is Jennifer Crow. She is a researcher at Universidad Nacional at the Central American Institute for Studies on Toxic Substances and the Program for Health, Work, and Environment in Central America. Jennifer's finishing her PhD in Epidemiology and Public Health, coincidentally at Umeå University in Sweden. Don't know if you two already knew each other. Her research interests include migrant populations, community-based participatory research, and climate change.
So we actually didn't know that we had both submitted abstracts and much less knew that we were submitting them to the same section. So it's a good surprise to see Rebecca here. And I think actually it's a really good thing that these two presentations are given back to back, because what Rebecca presented is very theoretical, or not very theoretical, but I'd like to give a little more of a specific example of why this really is a social justice issue in the framework of climate change, which is why a lot of you are here. I should say that this, and please excuse my voice, I'm barely back to having a voice after a rough week with a cold, so I'll do my best here. Should say that this work is done as a part of my work as a researcher at La Universidad Nacional in Costa Rica with the Regional Institute of Studies on Toxic Substances and the program SALTRA that Catherine mentioned. It's also part of my PhD work at Umeå in Sweden and is supported by the Hot HAPS initiative, which is an initiative to focus more attention on the effects of climate change in worker populations. All right. So I don't have any financial interest to disclose. And this has absolutely nothing to do with what I'm doing with my work in Costa Rica. But I always present this when I talk about heat and tell a little story. Before moving back to Costa Rica, I worked in the state of Washington with a University of Washington, and we had a really neat environmental justice community-based participatory research project with migrant workers in the part of the state where they grow all the apples and tree fruits. And the project was designed to let the worker community, their families, pick the environmental and occupational issues that they thought we as an academic and community partnership should work on. And so there were all kinds of techniques used. We did surveys and cane foreman interviews and group chats and all kinds of stuff like that. And over again, the issue of heat came up. And it embarrasses me to say this, but when that happened, I frankly was concerned. I really felt like heat was it's something that's uncomfortable. It's not a good thing for workers. It's something that should be addressed in the workplace. But when I looked at this worker population, I thought, geez, we've got pesticides, we've got water contamination, we've got air contamination, we've got living conditions that are need to be addressed. And I'm worried that this is going to be the top priority, and I'm not sure it should be, but it's what the community thinks. Well, so it was one of several top priorities, and after that happened, the summer after that, a worker died in Washington State, and another worker died in California, agricultural workers due to heat. And this was produced or commissioned by the United Farm Workers Association to draw attention to the issue of heat in agriculture workers. So it was a good lesson for me, and it's something that I try and keep in mind. I had no idea I would be doing heat work even after that, and certainly it wasn't part of my plans, but again, find myself with a worker population that has this as a major concern, and I think it's something that hasn't gotten enough attention. So I will talk mostly about health effects because, and Rebecca mentioned most of the productivity concerns, but just to reinforce the physiological reality, I mean, there's a point in which our bodies, whether we're running a marathon or cutting sugarcane or doing whatever we're doing, that there's a limit to how long we can carry out that metabolic load that exercise or work implies. And so there is an effect on productivity, and Rebecca mentioned this, the Monitor report put out by this is Climate Vulnerable Forum, which is a group of countries that got together, developing countries, that got together to try and put pressure on the developed countries in terms of making policy in climate change. And so one of the things they do is produce a report, and in the latest report, in the case of Costa Rica, The most important economic impact of climate change for the country is predicted to be this loss of productivity. And we'll talk about this a little bit more, but in the case of sugarcane, when you get paid by how much you cut, that productivity measure is an important measure not only for the sugarcane industry and for the country, but for the individual person who's working as well. So a little bit about why we do this. The top map is Central America, and the little green country there is Costa Rica. We're a very tiny country the size of West Virginia with about 4 million people. And as someone who grew up in the United States, in Costa Rica, there's no one would ever question whether or not climate change is happening, or whether or not anyone's felt that. I mean, people just, that climate change is happening. We're definitely aware of this. And so it's something that's very much in the general consciousness. And the public health community in general has been a little behind in recognizing the health effects, potential health effects of climate change, but now we're finally getting to that. And then there's been some good work done in terms of identifying effects of climate change in worker populations. And we're going to focus, there are quite a few, but we're going to focus in this presentation on the effects of increasing heat and increasing duration and frequency of heat waves, which would be the two conditions that could negatively affect workers exposed to heat. And then vulnerable populations. And when we see the reports about climate change, we tend to see the normally cited vulnerable populations, elderly and children. And I'd like to make the case today that we also want to be thinking about young, healthy men as a vulnerable population in this case. So it's kind of a shift in our thinking. And in terms of sugarcane harvesting in Costa Rica, on the bottom map, the, most northwestern part that's green there, that's the Guanacaste region. If you've ever visited Costa Rica, you know that some of our best beaches are there. And it's a low-lying, flat area, and it's also very, very good for sugarcane production. More than 50% of the sugarcane is produced and harvested there and processed as well. And it's done almost entirely at this point by a migrant labor force. So there are some Costa Ricans cutting sugarcane. There are some undocumented workers shedding sugarcane. But a very large portion are actually brought with a special permission, a visa permit from Nicaragua and an agreement with the other country. So they are literally contracted by a subcontractor in Nicaragua a month or two before the harvest season. They're picked up in a bus the day before the harvest season starts. They drive to Costa Rica. They live in a labor camp. This is usually the last week of November until about middle of April. Stay the time, full time in Costa Rica, driven back the day after the harvest season finishes, and then return to whatever work they do in Nicaragua. So it's clearly a labor force that has quite a few social determinants of health issues going on for them as well. Then we have this whole dynamic. There's actually an increase of production in Costa Rica and in several countries. Nicaragua is a notable one as well, because of the use of sugarcane for biofuel production, which is another whole conversation we could have, and I won't get into that here. That's happening as well. And finally, and perhaps most importantly, and it actually isn't up there, but for some of you may have seen in the latest American Journal of Public Health communication about an epidemic of chronic kidney disease that we're seeing not only in Costa Rica but along the entire Pacific coast of Central America and the southern part of Mexico, and largely in sugarcane harvesters, young men who are not diabetic, not obese, not hypertensive, and are for the most part in jobs such as sugarcane that require a large physical force to carry out. So we suspect that working conditions have something to do with that. And then why were we working in sugarcane in general? The program Health, Work, and Environment in Central America had been working in the sugarcane industry for years, doing some participatory work with the workers to identify issues. Heat had come up in that, but there are clearly lots of issues. This is a very, very common occurrence to see the trucks at work. Once the sugarcane harvest season starts, it does not stop. So once it starts, the plant goes 24 hours a day. You have a lot of people working, full force, 24 hours a day. So it's an intense time. It tends to be a dangerous time. I will, thank you. And then as I get into our results, And I'll lose my voice entirely. When the first stage of the 3-year study was, would you bring me the cough drops that are in the front part of my bag there? We did a pilot stage in the first year, and one of the first things we did was to talk to the workers, and I asked them, thanks. You know, guys, we're going to do this study, and we've talked about what we're going to do and everything. Is there anything you think we should know before we get started? And one of the guys raised his hand, and he said, you know, what I think you should know is, listen, most of us have done a lot of jobs. We've done a lot of really crappy jobs, but really this is the worst there is. And that has been important for me to keep in mind. And actually, we just published recently, and when we sent in the... excuse me, just a second. Let's see. Give it a try. Okay. When I sent the paper in for one of the persons that reviewed it, I had put a statement like saying something about the lack of choice that workers have when they choose to work in sugarcane. And one of the reviewers suggested that we change that wording, suggesting that workers did have a choice in where they chose to work. And I really think that in this case that's not happening, and that's something that I'd like to keep present in this conversation. So I think I'm going to speed up the presentation because I may not finish it otherwise, but it's a 3-year study. We had a pilot phase that was largely qualitative and a main part of the study the second year, in which we did qualitative techniques, but also measurements of wet bulb globe temperature index and a symptom questionnaire with 111 harvesters and 63 non-harvesters working in the same company but not exposed to heat, not exposed to as much heat. In the third year, we meant to do an evaluation of the recommendations that we had recommended to the company. It didn't work out quite as we thought, and that's another story I can tell you about if you want, but we did try and implement what the company had decided to do to improve conditions for their workers. So we'll just present very, very briefly about results, but to give you a little bit of an idea, sugarcane is burned before it's cut in Costa Rica. That's technically not legal, but for the most part, it's still done. And I said Guanacaste is the largest sugarcane growing region. We're talking about 30,000 hectares every year that are being planted, harvested, and as a result, many of them burned, unless they're cut by machines, in which case it's done without burning. And usually you cut in pairs, so you go down a row. And this was one of the reasons we actually wanted to study sugarcane. We thought it would be easy to study production or productivity effects because you're paid by how much you cut, and we were not able to get that information from the company we worked with in the end. But this is to give you an idea of kind of how much they're actually working in a day. I'm going to skip this and come back to it in a second. Rebecca mentioned the wet bulb globe temperature index. And the reason we talk about this index, like the heat index, is how hot it feels instead of just the dry temperature, is because when it's the difference between a muggy day and an okay day outside, right, and we want to be talking about the worst conditions for a worker is a day where there's a lot of humidity because your sweat won't evaporate and there's no wind, again, because your sweat won't evaporate. So we talk about this wet bulb globe temperature index. And in the case of sugarcane harvesters, using the international norms, we were able to estimate the metabolic load of sugarcane harvesting. And if you weren't all in nice clothes and in nice rows there, I would have you all stand up. And just to give you an idea of what we're talking about with this metabolic load, but to cut sugarcane, we're talking about raising your right arm, or your left arm, all the way above your shoulder. You're crouching down using your largest muscle groups, those are in your legs. You're also bending at the waist, and you have to use full force to cut the stalk of sugarcane. It's like bamboo, but solid in the middle. And so And you have to do that an inch above the ground. So it really, really, and if you're cold outside while you're waiting for the shuttle bus in the morning, just try that a few times and you'll be warm fast. I mean, there's no way to not get warm doing that, even if you're in terrific shape. So when we know that metabolic load and using the pre-established curves, we know what the limit is for how when a worker can work at 100% effort and not be in danger of being in heat stress, and that is not being in danger of raising their core temperature to a level that's dangerous for the body. So this is an old graphic, but my point, I just want to say briefly and bring this back to the context of climate change, is that, and you'll see when I show the data that's coming in the next slide, when we hear about a one degree increase, or 2 degree increase, a 4 degree increase, and it doesn't seem like a lot to us, it is a lot in the context of a worker who's working at the limits of his or her physiological abilities. So just to give a little bit of our results from Costa Rica, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, the little red box there is the wet bulb globe temperature, I guess it's a thermometer, monitor. And here are our results. This is 26 is the red line there. Again, not degrees, not dry temperature. Again, it's on the index, but that's the level where it's safe to work at 100% effort without a break. And we started measurements at 6 in the morning. Workers tend to work as soon as it's light outside, but it depends on how long it takes them to get to the field. And they work until they get tired. And so, but then again, remember that they're only getting paid for what they cut. So the choice of leaving the field or not is one that's debatable. But you can see in you may not be able to see, between 7, 7:45, 8 o'clock, we're really passing that threshold. So then you have workers that are in heat stress conditions for the rest of the shift. And I should say before that, we did symptom questionnaires, completely self-reported. We were not able to successfully do any real measurements, and I will say that in front of you who are thinking about trying this, we were going to measure weight as an indication of hydration. Tried this for 2 years. The first year I thought, well, I don't want the field assistants to have any degree of doubt, so I'm not taking, well, first we thought, well, everybody said, you know, you need the doctor's scale, so, but you saw the pictures of the field, we have to carry this in a kilometer and hope that it's still calibrated and hope we have something to flat lay, put it on, and, you know, and so that wasn't going to be practical. So then I thought, well, I don't want a needle scale because then there's too much degree of uncertainty, and who reads, you know, 56 kilograms and who reads 57? Digital scale. Tried it out a few times. Took it out into the field, and after 9 o'clock in the morning, the darn thing wouldn't work because there was so much heat that the ink just made a big splotch on the scale. So then we took up needle scales the next year, and I thought, well, even with the degree of difference, the reports that we've heard from other countries of sugarcane harvesters are enough that we should still be able to see them even with the degree of difference, and they also didn't work in the heat. So be careful if you try to do that in really hot conditions. Get good scales. We asked about heat-related symptoms. We asked about other symptoms that we know are related to sugarcane harvesting, for example, sneezing, but that shouldn't be related to heat. That's because of the ash and the excess material from the sugarcane that they burn to use the to process or to power of the processing plant. And then we asked some teasers to see, you know, what we could find between harvesters and non-harvesters. These are the heat-related conditions. The dark bar are the harvesters, and the light bar are non-harvesters. And these are people who are reporting these symptoms at least once per week during the whole harvest season. So we have tachycardia, nausea, headache, fever, difficulty breathing, swelling of the hands and feet, and dizziness. And vomiting is the only that's not significant. I think that's actually just because of the low number of people. And just we did see significant differences also in some of the symptoms, like we thought we might. In things like sneezing is not a good example. Sneezing was one where we saw the two populations with similar symptoms as we expected. But when we asked about the teasers, we found again what we thought. There's no significant differences between what the harvesters and the non-harvesters are reporting. This is diarrhea, nosebleed, stomach ache, which is questionable whether it should be associated with nausea or not, trouble buttoning a shirt, or earache. So just to finish up, and I won't get into a discussion, but just some things that in the context of this session that I think are worth reflecting on. Like the guy waiting for the bus there, there's a limit to what is acceptable in terms of adapting to climate change and adapting to, you know, conditions in the workplace. And especially for these guys, they have to wear long sleeves, they have to wear long pants. Most of them wear two layers of shirts because of the, for those of you who have been in contact with corn, if you ever detasseled it, anything like that, there's little hairs on the leaves. It's the same thing for sugarcane, but to a much higher degree. And then the ash. And so you really need to be protected. And of course, the sun. And then you're covered with ash, and so your sweat isn't evaporating as successfully as it should. And as I said, I really think we need to pay attention to young men, women as well, but in our case, in this workplace setting, men as a vulnerable population in terms of climate change. And then the other thing that I think is important to keep in mind when we talk about adaptation measures, so we talk about changes in the workplace in terms of protecting these workers, we often focus on behavioral changes. So the worker should drink more water. The worker should drink hydration solution. Very true, and you know, workers have, we all have a responsibility in our workplaces. But if you can see in these pictures, these guys are advancing, you know, several kilometers as they head in. And every time that I want my water bottle, they take two 4-liter jugs of water out, leave them, walk, harvest, want the water, to come back to where the water is, walk, carry it back, and drink the water. And so, first of all, it heats up a lot and is no longer desirable to work or drink. And second of all, that's no rest, really, to actually have to do that. So in terms of thinking about changes, think about how much choice is really involved for folks. So just to say that workplace is an existing threat and is also a threat in the context of climate change, and that it's important both for health and productivity for workers in Central America, and that we really need to work on those preventative strategies, but making them realistic and the realities of the heat that our workers face and the conditions they face. And just to say, this is, I recognize the folks that I work with. On the right is the moon. That's how dark it is when they start. There really is no more room for adjusting the time period in which they're working. They're working as early as they can in the coolest hours that they can. But this work was funded by national funds from Costa Rica. And the work for me that in Salta Rumio, as I said, David Morales is one of the first researchers from Costa Rica, and Andres Robles as well. The company where we worked, it took some guts to open their doors to us, and they did, and the harvesters as well, to work with us for 3 years. And then I had a really, really good group of young undergraduate students, actually, that were helping us. So thanks to all of them, and thank you for listening.